Andrew Horowitz here, your host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, and welcome back to me because I have been traveling. You know, I've been all over Europe, Eastern Europe, Northern Europe. My wife had me on an extremely rigorous travel schedule where I believe we hit somewhere close to 5 countries in 11 days. And don't get me wrong, it was just an amazing experience. I had a great time. As a matter of fact, I just listened recently to my last podcast, and I heard when I had spoken about Red Square how many times I used the word amazing. I must have said it close to 10 times. I was totally blown away. What a great experience. Really, if you have the opportunity to do so, you should spend some time over there. When I got back, one of the first things I did was I went and I got myself the iPhone. I know. If you've been reading any of my blog posts and listening to me talk, I said that the iPhone was an area of concern. But remember something. I talked about the iPhone from the aspect of the iPhone as a questionable device because really the competition's pretty stiff. That's what I said, number one. Number two, I said I thought the stock was getting ahead of itself in face of the iPhone. Well, I was wrong to that. I got to be honest with you, because whether the stock is truly priced correctly or there is still a major amount of fluff in it because of the iPhone and people are just buying things at will these days, whatever the case may be, the stock is up another 15 points or so, maybe 20 points now, since the iPhone has been introduced. Let's put that aside for a minute. Not that I don't want to talk about it. Not that I'm ashamed of the fact that I said that Apple stock was kind of ahead of itself. That's okay. You know, we all make mistakes. The fact of the matter is we are long for some of our clients in that position. But yet at the same time, I was hedging it because I was concerned that it did look a little frothy. But put that aside for a second. We have some important things to talk about. One of the things we're going to talk about is the markets, because I got home and, you know, the markets went up. And then what happened was amazing. The markets went up some more. And then a few days later, the markets went up some more. The markets are up every single day since I've been back, I think. And I don't think there's been, maybe there's one day that it went down, but the next day it just turned around. It doesn't matter the bad news. It doesn't matter the price of oil. It doesn't matter what is happening with corporate earnings. It doesn't matter. The market is obviously just going to go up forever, it seems. Or does it? Well, our guest today does tell us that the market, in his opinion, is going to be somewhere about 20,000. That's the Dow now. It's going to hit 20,000 in not too distant future. Matter of fact, want to hear something really cool? He predicted in April 1st, that the market should move 2,000 points. Again, the Dow should move 2,000 points in a very quick manner. And it did. His name is Harry Dent, and he's an economist. We're going to have him on the show in a minute. We're going to talk to him about where he sees the markets going, why he's so bullish, when it's going to stop, and what are going to be the factors in actually slowing this thing down, or maybe it won't. So I'm really excited that he's going to be calling in a second, and we're going to get on the discussion with him, and we're going to talk with him. Right now, what I want you to do, we're going to prepare to talk today about a few things first. We're going to be discussing some of the market issues, some things that I think you need to be aware of. And I think this is going to be a great podcast. So do me a favor, stick around for a minute, because we are rocking today. I mean, we have a great conversation I know is going to happen. This guy is going to knock your socks off. And it's all happening right here on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Stick around. We'll be right back.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager.
Hey, welcome to Andrew Horowitz's home, the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I am so happy you can be with us. I want to tell you something really cool. Do you know that over the last few months, we have had a 20% increase on average each and every month in listeners to the show? And I am so pleased. Obviously, we're doing something right, I think. Either that or other people are doing something very wrong. I'm not sure which one it is. But I want to thank you very much for telling your friends and for doing what you can to promote the show. I want to thank you so much because it means a lot to me. Do me a favor. One more thing that I always tell you means a lot to me, iTunes. If you're anywhere near iTunes right now, stop for a second. Go to the iTunes entry for the Disciplined Investor and leave some feedback. Just quickly put, hey, I like the show. It's great. I don't like the show. It stinks. Whatever you're going to say. But just leave me some feedback, because that's one of the great ways that we get noticed by more people out there. The more feedback we have, it seems, the better that our show seems to move up the charts. And I'm just one of these guys that needs to climb to the top, I guess. That's number one. Number two, good news. The book is now at the printer. So those of you who have requested, and we got several people who had requested, many people, I should say, that have requested a pre-order copy, because the pre-order copies are going to come with my personal insignia, if you will, my personal note, my personal signature, my personal thank you in the book. So if you want to pre-order the book called The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, it's going to teach you all sorts of things about investing that you never thought about before, each and every point about fundamental investing, technical analysis, quantitative investing, mutual funds, even annuities, it's in this book. Go to the Disciplined Investor blog site at www.thedisciplinedinvestor, and then all you have to do is simply just say that you want to pre-order. There is no charge to pre-order. We're going to charge you when it ships, which is going to be approximately April 15th or so. August 15th, not April, August 15th. We'll ship the book right out to you. So if you want that, please do so right now. Otherwise, I want to give you some heads up on what's going on the blog, because we're getting a lot of reaction, a lot of commentary, a lot of discussion from some of the things that I've been talking about lately. On the blog, I've written about a company called Rediff, which is the Indian Baidu, Google, Yahoo. It's got some problems. It's not the same as those companies, but it is one of the very, very important companies when it comes to internet search and portals in India. If you know anything about India, it is one of the fastest growing countries in the world. So what you want to do is take a look at that, the article on Rediff. I also wrote an article on Authorize.net, and that is a company that deals with the prepayment approval process for credit cards on the net. If you think that the net is going to continue to expand in the area of credit card authorization because of obviously sales of goods and services on the internet, you want to go and check that article out. I think it's going to talk about a few things that are going to be very interesting. I've talked about Crocs again and again, that it's a short and I don't like it. I think the stock is well overvalued. During this week, when the stock market was up day in and day out, Crocs was down consistently every single day. The only day that it moved up slightly, even though the market was up that day, was the day that they announced their new affiliation and arrangement with Major League Baseball. And Major League Baseball is going to have some new Crocs coming out. But I got to tell you, I put a video up there. Go to the site and check out this video, because this video talks about how in Belgium, in Copenhagen, and probably in many other places around the world, Crocs are being copied left and right. And that is a problem. When a company is finding their products being copied, that is a direct impact on their net earnings, because the revenue isn't coming in. And we're seeing it left and right all over the world. I would be concerned. I think it's a fad. I'm sorry if they're comfortable. I'm sorry if you like them. I am not talking about the shoe. I'm talking about the company. I'm talking about the earnings. I'm talking about the future. The fact is, we've seen it time and time again, and I'm very concerned about this stock. I think it has about 7 to close to 10 points moving on the downside. Don't be surprised if it happens before the end of the summer into the next earnings, because that could be a real a seesaw event, real questionable timing on that. Other than that, I also have a few articles on the market and a couple of other positions. I talk about, there's a segment from the book on how to value a stock. How do you actually go about looking at a stock? How do you look at valuing it? There is a post on that. So if you haven't had the opportunity to go to the site, there's tons of information there that I don't cover in the podcast at thedisciplinedinvestor.com, www.thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Now with that, what we're going to do is take just a moment of time. We're going to set up to have a call and a conversation with Harry Dent. It is going to be an amazing conversation. I know this because I've read his work. I've studied his work. I've talked with him. This is something that you have not heard before. Demographic economics. How, in fact, are we going to have a position in the Dow at 20,000 before 2009? And why and when is the next stock market disaster, recession, the crash, the real crash, not the mini crash, the real crash, the total meltdown of our economic system and our real estate and our stock market? When is that going to happen? First of all, everybody, let you need to know that I am a huge fan of Mr. Dent. He is the founder and president of HS Foundation, whose mission, as they say it, is helping people understand change. And they use exciting new research developments from years and years of hands-on experience. And really what they do is they do economic and market predictions moving out. And in his original book, The Great Boom Ahead, that was published in 1992, I personally read that, and I must have read it like five times, and the book is tattered and torn. It is an amazing book. He has many, many books since then, a few books, I should say, Roaring 2000s, he has continually predicted some amazing things. So thank you for joining us today, Mr. Dent.
Well, nice to be here.
One of the things I wanted to talk about, and I think get right into, is, you know, in your opinion, what is it that you do, and how are you different than most economists?
Well, we look at what I call like a science of demographics. Economists are looking at all types of, you know, government factors and monetary and fiscal factors and geopolitical forces, which all have their impact here and there. But the most fundamental things, the most fundamental thing that drives the economy is people and how we spend, earn, borrow, and do all types of things predictably as we age. So demographics is the most important factor, and economists don't study that hardly at all. Nevertheless, see it as the primary factor driving our economy. And along with that, we look at technology trends, which also comes from the innovation primarily of younger people and new generations like the baby boom that come along and bring new technologies and then adopt them predictably. So there's kind of like a predictable path of how we adopt new things that become major. And that's called the S curve, and we call that the demographics of adoption, because certain people adopt new innovations first, and certain people adopt them in the end.
Well, we're going to be talking about a lot of things today, and I'm going to put a lot of the information, like a picture of a current S curve or an S curve for maybe mobile phones, and some of your predictions, you know, on the show notes, so people can understand this and see it more visually. But one of the interesting things, you talk about an aging population, and I think what's also interesting about the research here is you don't just look at it moving forward. You do comparisons backward, and you look at your historical reference with similar time frames to project forward.
Yes, like I say, we can correlate the number of people moving to their peak spending between age 45 and 49, you know, back to the 1950s and measure it versus the Dow Jones or S&P 500 adjusted for inflation, and the correlation's incredible. I mean, despite all types of geopolitical events and major changes in the dollar and currencies and even interest rates and things like that, the economy basically follows the spending and productivity patterns of these new generations as they age, and every generation gets to the point like Japan's did in the late 1980s ahead of us, where they get too old. When most of people move in their 50s and 60s, well, these people save and they don't spend. And right. And that's the reason Japan slowed down, which we predicted back in the late 80s, and why the United States and Europe and increasingly emerging countries continue to boom.
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, over the time you've made adjustments and you've made interim changes to your predictions, because you've really been pretty much, you know, on target in terms of the major booms that we've had. And you really, I think, back to early 90s, were predicting a gigantic move in our markets because there was so much money to be spent by these baby boomers. And we had this hiccup in 2000 and 2001, 2002. But your latest prediction in April, on the cover of your April newsletter, you said very clearly 2,000 points more for the Dow in a very short fashion. Where are we going from here? I mean, first of all, let me say congratulations, because you were, I mean, not only right on, it's exact. At this point. But where are we going now? What's happening forward?
Well, we think we're just moving into the next, you know, little bull market that'll take us closer to 15,000 by probably September, 14,800 to 15,000. Then we think we'll probably have a little more of a setback there late this year, and then we'll see another strong move throughout 2008. Now, it's around late 2008 that we start getting cautious, because our long-term forecast, like you know, way back from the beginning in the late 80s and early 90s, said, hey, the baby boomers were going to start to peak around the end of this decade in their spending and productivity, right, and we would start to slow like Japan did in the 90s. So we think this year and next year continue to be very good for the stock markets. The bubbles in China and emerging markets are going to continue. But starting in 2008, we start to lose some steam in the markets, and by 2009, late 2009, we think the next major crash is going to set in.
And again, looking back at the Japanese market as a benchmark for this theory, I mean, we had, what, a prolonged 10-year-plus time period that the Japanese markets really spiked, did really well, then just fell out and just did nothing.
Yeah, that's right. We were calling back in the late 80s for a 12- to 14-year downturn, the Japanese. You know, again, it's just in between generational spending booms. And, yes, the market peaked right at the beginning of 1990, and it didn't bottom until early 2003. So it was about 13-and-a-half-year bear market, and The Nikkei was down 80%, even though the rest of the world was booming, particularly the United States in the 90s. So that shows how, you know, a generation impacts that strongly the spending in a country like Japan or the U.S. Yes, Japan exports and so do we, but it's still a small percentage of the overall economy.
So let me ask you this. I mean, I know that you do much more of a big picture, but in terms of the Japanese markets and in terms of the aging and in terms of our markets, let's kind of fast forward to 2010, let's say, or maybe 2015. One of the things that I'm interested in is there an opportunity maybe to really look at some of the retirement and ACLFs and maybe hospitals and healthcare in general? Is that going to be something that's going to benefit from all this?
Yeah, it will, because most areas of spending for people, I mean, home, that people spend the most money on homes in their late 30s, early 40s, so we're already past that. That's why housing is slowing down, and it's not going to come roaring back like in past booms from this slowdown. But they continue to spend more on cars and home furnishings and food and college and all this type of stuff in the late 40s. And people still continue to spend on things like entertainment and travel and leisure into their mid-50s. But between the late 40s and mid-50s, most things turn down. Now, the one big exception, the one large part of our economy is healthcare. Spending on drugs, legal drugs, of course, prescription drugs, goes up until we die, age 77, 78 on average. A lot of healthcare areas peak anywhere between the late 40s and the late 60s or late 70s. So healthcare will be the greatest sector of our economy to continue to grow, even though our overall economy slows after 2009 or 10.
So I think that from your latest, I read your October and your April newsletter, which, by the way, if anybody wants to get a copy, if you go to hsdent.com, you're giving away past editions, because you do obviously.
Yeah, I think the April issue is probably out now, which is a good one, because we also not only have a long-term forecast, but we also gave a good summary of the next 15 years.
Right. And one of the things that you mentioned in there, or many of the things you mentioned, is there's a couple of little monkey wrenches in there. For example, I thought it was brilliant, and you really pointed something out. You said, you know, there's a lot of tension in the Middle East, and this geopolitical issue with Iran and Iraq is a real problem. And just think about it. Step back for a second and think about it. What happens if oil prices go down? What happens to the tension then? I mean, I think really, you know, that's not been thought about. You know, right now they're rolling in the hay with money and oil's great and things are good over there, and they're still, you know, miserable and they're causing all sorts of problems. I mean, what happens when oil prices go down, if they go down? But where are we going with oil? I mean, it doesn't seem that oil at $78 a barrel is causing any problems for anybody.
Not a lot. I mean, it did hurt. I mean, we expected the markets, this next bubble, to take off in 2005, and it really waited till mid-2006 because oil prices went all the way up to $78 last year, and that did start to wear on the market. But now the market's kind of accepted that. And, hey, if it jumped to $100 this year, that'd be a problem for the market. But as long as it stays below 78, which I think it will, it's not a problem for now. But we see oil, and this is a whole new cycle we factored in. People should also know our last book, The Next Great Bubble Boom, that came out in 2004. We have a free update to that on our website as well, like a 20, 30-page update, where we bring in a new geopolitical cycle, and we do a lot of analysis about commodity and oil cycles. And what we see, and this is unusual for booms like this, most booms don't have commodity prices and oil prices going up. I mean, in the 70s that happened, but that was a bust. So we see a peak in demographic spending coming over the next few years, along with a continued boom in commodity and oil prices on a 29, 30-year cycle. So we expect oil probably to come back up here, get near the highs again, pull back probably in the next year or so, and then a final bubble that's going to take us over $100, $105 our best guess, but it could be a little higher, into 2009, early 2010. So any corrections in the energy and commodity stocks, we're looking to add those more to our portfolios, and we think those energy and commodity stocks will continue to go up well into 2009 and maybe even early to mid-2010, when a lot of the growth stocks and emerging markets are starting to slow down.
And let's talk about the convergence, because there's about, I think, three or four different converging issues that you talk about that's going to happen in about that 2009, 2010. There's a few different cycles, like the presidential cycle, and a few that are all sort of this convergence that's going to be, you know, this horrible event that's going to happen in the markets.
Yeah, again, first of all, we've been in a boom since the early 80s for the baby boom spending, in the largest generation in history here and around the world. So that's why this boom's been so strong, despite crashes and events.
Right.
That was joined by a growing technology S-curve cycle around the internet and wireless in the mid-90s, and that is continuing despite the crash, and crashes come right in the middle of those cycles. Those two cycles, the tech cycle on our S-curve peaks between late 2008 or so around, and the demographic cycles peak more around late 2009 or maybe even a little later, and those start to slow down. That's the first thing. But then we have this commodity price cycle that's going to work adversely to markets increasingly, that peaks probably around early to mid-2010. That's a negative factor that starts to hit the markets.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have these two cycles. You mentioned the decennial cycle. Most
right.
people are not aware that the riskiest time for the markets is early in every decade, particularly the first year. On average, the markets are down in the first 2 to 3 years of every decade. Look at the 80s, look at the 90s, look at the early 2000s. Despite one of the greatest, in fact, the greatest boom in history, we still have substantial corrections and minor to even more substantial recessions in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So the decennial cycle turns down around late 2009, and then we have our next four-year presidential cycle, which we just saw bottom last year in 2006, and before that, 2002. That's going to hit in 2010. So we think the greater, when we look at all these cycles with commodity prices peaking around late 2009 to mid-2010, four and decennial cycles kicking in, the other cycle fundamental slowing, that the most dangerous year for the stock market is going to be between late 2009 and late 2010, and we expect some of the growth markets and bubbles to start popping between late 2008 and 2009. So we have another good, let's say, year and a half left in the markets, and they're going to be better than anybody thinks, and continue to be very strong overseas and emerging markets, but we're going to see our first extended down markets in our lifetimes as baby boomers, as investors at least, and it's not going to be over in a few years. It's
right.
going to last many years, like the Japan downturn.
Well, the thing that you mentioned, I think, over and over about where to reinvest and what to continually invest in is Asia ex Japan, including in India and a few other areas. And I think that maybe it has to do with the demographics and the amazing number, the sheer number of people that are there and they're spending and what happens. I mean, I always say that, in China, there's how many billion people and what are they eating per day? And I mean, where's all that food coming from? I mean, it's a lot of food.
Yeah, there's 1.3 billion people there. Well, what's important, I mean, we've got billions of people in the developing world and in a demographic cycles that should be strong. But until a country gets on a development path, gets some level of law and order and some level of government stability and markets and all these sort of things, and democracy usually, they don't really get on the development path. And China's clearly on that. India's
mm-hmm.
getting on that. Vietnam, and of course Hong Kong and South Korea long before that. So what we're seeing in the world, and this is really important to get long term, is that we're at a major divide where the Western countries have been driving the world and GDP for decades and centuries. And all of a sudden, starting with Japan, then moving to Europe and partially the U.S., and then to China and around, that these more developed countries are going to start to age and slow down, and more of these emerging countries are going to get on the bandwagon and start to develop, like Vietnam has recently
right.
here in India. So the world is going to shift towards Asia and even Latin America to a lesser degree. And this is not just a short-term slowdown for a lot of Western countries, especially Europe. It's a long-term slowdown unless something happens to reverse births and deaths. And deaths is the more likely positive outcome, that people start living longer a decade or so out. But this is a major slowdown ahead for the West,
right.
but a continued boom for most of the rest of the world outside of Europe and North America.
What's interesting, I just got back from a trip to Russia and the Nordic countries 3 or 4 days ago. And in Russia, they are paying, actually, you get the equivalent of $10,000 for the second child to be born. So obviously the government is well aware that they need to do something about replenishing the population.
Yes, and Russia and East Europe, along with Southern Europe, are the places that are going to slow the fastest, along with Japan. And again, surprise of all surprises, China is growing rapidly, catching up the Western standard of living rapidly, moving people from rural to urban areas rapidly, but they are aging rapidly. They've had
right.
a one-child policy since the 70s,
yep.
and they are, by 2015, their demographics start to slow down, and by 2035, they will be losing population unless something changes. So China is going to be the fastest growth story and slowdown in history. India and other parts of Asia have much longer growth paths than China.
So I have two things I want to talk about. Then I want to get into the S-curve issue. Corporate earnings. You know, one of the things that I've seen lately and really over the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years in a really big way is the buyback programs, the corporate buyback programs. And one of the things that happens with buybacks is that there are less shares in the market. And with less shares in the market, you have higher earnings per share, right? Simple.
Right.
What am I missing here that it seems to be that there's this, you know, continuation of everybody beating numbers, et cetera. But if they're all buying back shares and the EPS usually isn't adjusted because of the buyback, isn't this a little artificial here?
Well, I mean, you first have to get to what's causing this. Stocks are undervalued. Ever since the crash of 2002, large cap stocks, and particularly technology stocks, got slammed way down undervalued. And despite the continued turnaround of the economy, despite corporate earnings growing even faster than they did in the 90s bubble, stocks have, even though they're going up, they're not going up as fast as they did from 95 to 99.
Right.
Stocks are undervalued about 20% versus bonds. So that gives these people an incentive to borrow money or to use their excess cash flow to buy back their stocks. They're just really being rational. So what it really says is stocks are undervalued, and that's why stocks are going up. Even with oil prices going up, even with interest rates edging up, stocks are still undervalued, and people are looking at real estate. Well, that's not going up anymore in most places. They're looking at bonds. You buy long-term bonds, and interest rates creep up. You get hurt. Gosh, there's no place to go
right.
but stocks.
Well, that's exactly right. I also said that once we saw the real – first of all, I said two things. Number one, the longer the real estate hysteria goes on – it was hysteria there for a while.
Yes, it was,
you know, the longer it goes on, the harder it's going to fall, number
yeah.
one. Number two, what happens with all that money? Because people inherently want to invest. I mean, it's the way it is. So where's it going to go? There's not many places it's going to go into the markets. I mean, it really, I think all of this is in concluding with what's happening. And I think what you're also telling me and what I'm hearing from you is really what you're saying is, you know, let the noise, just let it just go. Let the interim days go, the ups and the downs, that February debacle of a few hundred points and the 200 points up the other day. I mean, just let that go and realize that the long-term path is really the next 3-4 years that we should be very bullish on these markets and just don't even listen to the interim noise.
Yeah, and again, look where money's been and look where it's going, because a lot of people miss. I mean, real estate's been going up for this entire boom since the early 80s,
right.
but it really accelerated from 2000, 2005, and that was precisely because the stock market, where all the money had gone in that bubble, started failing, and
right.
people said, well, where else do I put it?
Yep.
And it went into real estate. Well, when real estate slowed down, it's got to go back into stocks because bonds aren't that attractive. So, yeah, the trends are still up. Again, though, we're warning, you know, we're getting them. We've been known as the perennial bull since the late 80s. We're always bullish no matter how big a correction we have. But we're saying, but we are getting it near the end of this bubble boom. The baby boomers are going to slow down a few years from here. And some of these bubbles, especially overseas, are getting so exponential in China and stuff that they don't look like to us they can last past late 2008.
So
without
popping
from their own momentum.
Right.
Know?
What is your? I'm real concerned about this whole private equity, this new extraordinary levels of borrowing to buy companies above levels. I mean, you have companies trading at 40 and they buy them at 80 and however you want
yeah.
to slice it. Obviously, it makes sense from a private equity because they're borrowing so much at such a low price. But where does it end?
Well, see, you know, it ends when the train slows down. That's the problem. I mean, people can say, oh, I mean, they were saying recently with Blackstone going public, oh, this is a sign of the top. No, it's not. It's still rolling. But in a year or two, this is. It's going to get absurd again. There's going to be too much of this, too much leverage to do this. And as soon as things go down, that leverage starts to hurt.
Right, because now Blackstone has more money to do with because they went public.
In 98, we had a little... You know, the ruble went bad and we had a short-term crash in the markets and long-term capital management, big hedge fund almost went under.
Right.
Why? Because they had all this leverage and they thought an event that extreme in the short term couldn't happen with some faulty models. The markets are more risky. They do not follow a normal distribution as most financial planners and economists assume.
Mm-hmm.
They have much... fatter tails, they call them, where more extreme events on the upside and downside happen more often than you would think. So
right.
so this leverage is worrisome. But again, as long as the whole economy is doing well and everything's going up and interest rates stay reasonably moderate, although we think they're going to continue to edge up, this game will continue. But I tell you, when it ends, it's not going to end well, because this is just like the LBO craze all over again.
Yeah. So let's get into the discussion of an S-curve, because another fascinating thing that you've really, I think, very well explained, but I think it's interesting to bring out for people who have never discussed it. And the S-curve, from my understanding, is a relative adoption of whatever it may be, technology or a new idea. And generally, you have an S. It draws an S on a chart. And basically, you have the beginnings. You have your early adopters, the people who will try things, et cetera. And you have a slow, kick up to the adoption phase and to usability. Then we have a pretty good vertical line as to many people say, okay, this is a good thing, we're going to use it too. And then you get this phase off. So let's talk about this S-curve in terms of, and maybe you can better explain it, but in terms of some of the technology today, particularly I'm interested in mobile phones and mobility.
Yeah, it really is how we adopt things. What people are best at doing is copying other people like them or nearly like them. And so most people will not look at something new and different at first. I mean, it'll only be these early adopters and these innovators that'll do it. So that's a small minority of the population. So in the same time it takes for a product to get up to 10%, say, of households, the more fluid, innovative, early adopter types, it then goes from 10% to 90% of households in that same time period. So you get this acceleration. That's the vertical curve you talk about on the S. Most people think things move in straight line. I was at Firestone Tire Consulting way back, and radial tires had come in from Europe and taken 7 years to get 10% of the market, and all these companies were assuming in the next 7 years they'd have 20. In this next 7 years, they had 90% of the market.
Right.
And bias was pretty much put out of business. So it's an important concept. Since the mid-90s, since about 1994, internet, cellular phones, and now broadband even faster, new technologies are moving up that rapid acceleration into our homes. This not only creates big growth industries and technology, but it increases productivity. It's not just businesses using these technologies. The more consumers use these technologies, the more efficiently we can interact and do business and get better information. So this is the reason corporate earnings have been particularly strong since the mid-90s, and we've moved in not just from a boom, but into a bubble boom. Once these S-curves take off for major technologies like automobiles and electricity, or computers and internet and cellular phones today and broadband, they affect all of society, and that's when you see bubbles. So we've been telling people, despite the crash of 2000-2002, this bubble boom is still continuing, and that we would see new highs in the markets and we'd go into the next bubble, which we're doing now. And it actually turns out that the greatest bubbles now are in emerging markets.
So, one of the hottest things right now, obviously, cell phones. I was just in, like I said, Europe and all that. Nokia is everywhere. Cell phones are everywhere. They have giant stores, and there's lines to get in to buy cell phones. I mean, that's how it is. iPhone here was kind of a change to the, at least people thought it would be the change to the concept of what a cell phone is. More of a, I guess, a mini computer kind of quasi thing. I'm not sure how that fits into that mobile phone adoption S-curve or turns it on its ear a bit. But, what is the next early stage that we're seeing now? I mean, obviously, we went from big computers, desktops, laptops. That's another thing, right? That everything gets smaller. That's another type of desktop.
That's right. We went from mainframes to minis to PCs to laptops, like you say, to small. And now we've got handheld phones with more power than most of those computers had back
then. I suppose the next one's going to be chips in the head or something like that.
With broadband and increases of that, it's just incremental from here. I mean, by 2008, 2009 at the latest, 90% of households that are going to adopt these things are going to happen. And that's when the S-curve slows down. So it's not because technology companies are mismanaged or even investors were overly exuberant. When that slows down, their earnings will slow down, their growth will slow down, and this bubble in tech stocks will have to finally slow down. So there's a pause between S-curves. So your question's a good one, because there are new BAFO technologies emerging, nanotechnology. The real stage of biotech is still ahead of us, and robotics. Those are the things, along with alternative energy and green technologies, that are going to really transform the coming decades, but they are still in their infant stages. I mean, how many full battery cars do we have? A handful. They're starting to come. Nanotechnologies are having applications here and there, but it's nowhere near mainstream. It's nothing like the internet. So that's going to come, but we don't see those next clusters of technologies moving strongly mainstream until about 2020 to 2035, 36, or 38. So that's the next wave. What people miss is like in the 30s and early 40s, in between these major S-curve movements of technologies, the old will be slowing and the new will just be emerging in that 0 to 10, and so you don't see as much progress.
Right. There's a lot coming up, lots happening. So tell me, what is your next book? What's your next venture? What do you next see? What's happening for those people out there that want to read more about what you're doing?
Well, I'm talking to the publisher right now about the next book. It'll be somewhere between late 2008 and mid to late 2009.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be focusing for the first time in our books, in our writing history, on the slowdown, the crash.
Right.
It'll probably be called something like The Great Crash of 2010 or The Great Crash Ahead, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be focusing on the downturn, how you have to be conservative in the early stages because most markets will be down, including markets in Asia where they've got incredible demographics ahead of them. But, hey, they got bubbles too, and when the West slows down and most of these countries have a lot of their exports going to Europe, U.S. and stuff, they'll get hit at first and their bubbles will burst as well. What you want to do is be in safe investments between about late 2009 and in the first few years of the next decade, and then be looking to get in the right sectors like healthcare in the U.S. and in the right sectors overseas, like the best parts of Asia, and particularly India and places like that.
Right.
Once there's a crash and everything gets knocked down, and then you invest in the areas that still have growth. So that'll be our next book's focus. Frankly, I've done a lot of new venture investing. One of them, a company called Save Daily, that has affordable accounts for 401k and everyday investors. You know, all totally automated, easy to operate sort of thing, health savings accounts and things. But I'm most focused. I'm actually working on some real estate stuff in the Turks and Caicos because I think that is the up and coming kind of affluent hideaway. It's a safe place, tax haven, but most important, it's very eco oriented. Very high end and a very safe place. I think more and more.
I've actually been there. I dove there for a week with Green Turtle Divers, and spent a week on the wall. And what was it? The Banana Boat, I think, was my favorite restaurant there, if I'm not mistaken. And cool place. But some of those islands, actually, I was just at another island down in. Which one was that? We were at a really great dive island with the kids. I can't remember the name. But anyway, it's a beautiful area down there. I mean, towards the south part of the Caribbean, I think, is what you're talking about, too.
Yeah, it's on the south. No, it's on the south part of the Bahamas. So it's above the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico, but it's below the Bahamas. But what impressed me is that I follow all these boutique hotels, and that's the fastest growing part. Boutique resorts, particularly in island and vacation areas. And every major boutique hotel I know of is going to the Turks and Caicos. And the Caribbean doesn't have that many of these very high-end hotels. So it shows it's attracting a certain amount of type of people. And I think, you know, real estate is one of the biggest things we warn people about because people know stocks can crash. Even in good times, we've had big crashes.
Sure.
87,
right.
2000, 2002. They're volatile by nature, especially when they bubble up. But people think, you know, real estate can only goes up. They're not making any more of it. Well, Japan is the most dense real estate market in the world. In Tokyo, 40 million people, and they've been down for 15 years, 60% everyday real estate. People just don't think that's possible. So we're warning that's the biggest risk. We're telling you when to get out of stocks, but people need to realize real estate, you're going to have to be in the right areas, these vacation, resort, retirement, or for apartments for young people, because the typical single-family home market, it's over for a while with baby boomers.
Yeah, it's out of control what the pricing is. By the way, it was Curacao.
And the biggest bubble, on a relative basis, we show in our books that we've seen bubbles this big in stocks. We have never seen a bubble of this magnitude in housing and this much around the world. It's everywhere in the developed world.
Well, I know they can get your books at Amazon and on bookstores, et cetera, and I can go to your site. I'm going to put some links on the show notes so they can get right to your site to get the downloads and then maybe subscribe. There's a subscription to your, I believe it's a monthly newsletter, a quarterly monthly newsletter, and there's all sorts of great things. I got to tell you, folks, I've been following this gentleman for some time, and he's extraordinarily impressive. His work is, I mean, the charts and graphs that he's presents are, you know, you get those oh my moments. I'm very impressed. And I want to thank you so much for joining me today and spending some time with my audience because I've respected your work for many, many years, and it's a great honor for me to be able to speak to you.
Okay, well, thank you. I enjoyed it, Andrew.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Hey, thanks for listening to today's podcast. We'll be here next time. Keep the emails coming in and be sure to subscribe.